All right, look, here's the deal. I've got a hangover. Who knows what that means?
Doesn't that mean you're drunk?
No, it means I was drunk yesterday. The point is, y'all can just chill today. We'll start on this crapola tomorrow. Yes, Tinkerbell.
Summer, as class factotum, first I'd like to just say, welcome to Horse Green.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions about our schedule? Because usually now Miss Dunham teaches vocabulary, then gives us a pop quiz. Then she'll split us up into our reading groups. Track B's reading
okay,
charts.
Hey. Miss Dumbbum ain't your teacher today? I am. So I say, time for recess.
But Mr. S, that poster charts everyone's performance. We get gold stars when we master the material covered in class. How do we get gold stars if we just have recess?
What are these black dots here?
Demerits.
What kind of a sick school is this? Hmm?
Aldous Huxley, 1962. Discussing how people can learn to love their servitude.
Today, we are faced, I think, with the approach of what may be called the ultimate revolution, the final revolution, where a man can act directly on the mind-body of his fellows. Well, needless to say, some kind of direct action on human mind-bodies has been going on since the beginning of time. But this has generally been of a violent nature. The techniques of terrorism have been known from time immemorial, and people have employed them with more or less ingenuity, sometimes with the utmost crudity, sometimes with a good deal of skill acquired by a process of trial and error, finding out what the best ways of using torture, imprisonment, constraints of various kinds. But as I think it was Metternich said many years ago, you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. This is, seems to me, the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say. And this is a problem which has interested me for many years, and about which I wrote 30 years ago a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system. And since then I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem, and I have noticed with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true, or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already. and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude.
B.F. Skinner, 1954. Discussing how children can learn to love their schooling.
These young people are studying in a new way. Class in spelling, it might as well be arithmetic or algebra or grammar, or in fact anything involving the use of words or symbols. Each student is using a teaching machine, a device which creates vastly improved conditions for effective study. What are teaching machines? How are they used? What can they teach? Who prepares the material they teach? And how does this material differ from textbooks, lectures, and educational television? What impact will machine teaching have on school organizations? Some of these questions can be answered in at least a preliminary way. I am B.F. Skinner, professor of psychology at Harvard University. I should like to discuss some of the reasons why studying with the help of a teaching machine is often dramatically effective. With the machine you have just seen in use, the student sees a bit of text or other printed material in a window. This may be a sentence or two or an equation in arithmetic. Some small part is missing, and the student must supply it by writing on an exposed strip of paper. His response may be the answer to a question or the solution of a problem, but generally it is simply a symbol or word which completes the material he has just read. As soon as the student has written his response, he operates the machine and learns immediately whether he is right or wrong. This is a great improvement over the system in which papers are corrected by a teacher, where the student must wait perhaps till another day to learn whether or not what he has written is right. Such immediate knowledge has two principal effects. It leads most rapidly to the formation of correct behavior. The student quickly learns to be right. But there is also a motivating effect. The student is free of uncertainty or anxiety about his success or failure. His work is pleasurable. He does not have to force himself to study. A classroom in which machines are being used is usually the scene of intense concentration. One function of a teaching machine, then, is to give the student a quick report on the adequacy of his response. This is important not only for efficient learning, it generates a high level of interest and enthusiasm. Another important advantage is that the student is free to move at his own pace. With techniques in which a whole class is forced to move forward together, the bright student wastes time, waiting for others to catch up. And the slow student, who may not be inferior in any other respect, is forced to go too fast. Not quite completing one day's assignment, he is even less likely to complete a second. And he gets farther and farther behind, and often gives up altogether unless remedial steps are taken. A student who is learning by machine moves at the rate which is most effective for him. The fast student covers a course in a short time, but the slower student, by giving more time to the subject, can cover the same ground. Both learn the material thoroughly. A third feature of machine teaching is that each student follows a carefully constructed program, leading from the initial stage where he is wholly unfamiliar with the subject to a final stage in which he is competent. He does this by taking a large number of very small steps arranged in a coherent order. Each step is so small that he is almost certain to take it correctly. The material is designed to give the student as much help as possible. He is not in any sense being tested. Instead, helpful hints, suggestions, and prompts maximize the chances that he will be right. The fact that each step is very small is important. Even though it may not seem like much of an accomplishment, it is always progress in the right direction. Programs have been constructed in which, without any prior study, the average student is right 95% of the time. This result is partly due to the fact that the student only moves on when he has completely mastered all the preceding material. If he is absent, he does not miss any work because he takes up where he left off upon returning to the machine. A conservative estimate seems to be that with these machines, the average grade or high school student can cover about twice as much material with the same amount of time and effort as with traditional classroom techniques. There is no magic about this. A teaching machine is simply a convenient way of bringing the student into contact with the man who writes the program. It is the author of the program, not the machines, who teaches. He stands in the same position as a textbook writer, except that he is much closer to the student. He and the student are constantly interacting. This interaction can be mediated in different ways, of course, and each way means a different kind of teaching machine, each having special features and advantages.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back. Today is April 25th. You know, I want to start by saying, for many years, this podcast has provided me an outlet for discussing my thoughts, feelings, and of course, leftover frustrations from my experience in schooling. And I always hoped that it could do the same for others. But as you know, I don't hear from a lot of teachers. And I always wish I heard from more teachers who wanted to talk about their experience. Then, just last week, I received this email. Dear Brett, I've been binge listening to your show since discovering it, and I want to thank you for providing my introduction to libertarianism, as well as the fascinating and thoughtful discussions about science, the trivium, and nonviolent communication. I'm currently a teacher wrapping up my 15th and last year in the field, and I appreciate your perspective on how much the system impacts upon teachers as well as on students and families. As a child, I was obedient and invested in school. I followed the path laid out for me all the way to the Ivy League. But now, looking back on that quote-unquote success, I can see that I was indoctrinated into playing by the rules of the system. And it's only now, as an adult, I can step back and see how the system is set up to lead people like me to safe thinking and aspirations, to love Big Brother to the point where we sign on to help others learn to love him too. One topic I would love to see more prominently on your show is the conscious use of behaviorism to control the thoughts and actions of students, particularly in special education. This is unfortunately an area in which I've had lots of firsthand experience, having worked primarily with kids with diagnosed disability, including oppositional defiant disorder and ADHD, both in quotes. Just as a small example, this year, my school adopted an oppressive system of constant praising for compliance and publicly displaying children on a chart labeling their behavior, which I have simply refused to use. Even so, the structure of the classroom itself ensures that the environment is only functional when kids comply, defer to me as the authority, suppress their own needs and curiosities, and accept the structure imposed on their bodies and thoughts, including chemically in many cases. This moral dilemma was always working in the background, but in my early days of teaching, I had more freedom to work with the kids to try to make their experience more rewarding. Now, the structure has tightened up to the point where that's no longer possible. If you'd like to explore this topic further, I'd be happy to provide more details. I'm leaving teaching as soon as my contract is up, and I'm going to be homeschooling my own child. I am sure my school will quickly find some eager, naive replacement who will think she's helping kids overcome their issues. Thanks again for your podcast. It is really a great resource for those of us waking up out of the matrix. That email came from a woman who we are going to call Meredith, and she joins me on the show today. Now, the email mentioned behaviorism, and we have discussed behaviorism on the show before. I will link to those shows in the notes, but for those of you who might be new, I thought a little primer would be helpful. For those of you who are not new, I thought a little review would be helpful. So, what is behaviorism. From simple psychology, behaviorism was the primary paradigm in psychology between the 1920s to 1950s and is based on a number of underlying assumptions regarding methodology and behavioral analysis. Number one, psychology should be seen as a science. Theories need to be supported by empirical data obtained through careful and controlled observation and measurement of behavior. John Watson in 1913 stated that psychology, as a behaviorist views it, is a purely objective experimental branch of natural science. Its theoretical goal is prediction and control. Two, behaviorism is primarily concerned with observable behavior as opposed to internal events like thinking and emotion. Observable, i.e. external behavior, that can be objectively and scientifically measured. Internal events, such as thinking, should be explained through behavioral terms, or eliminated altogether. Three, people have no free will. A person's environment determines their behavior. Four, when we are born, our mind is a blank slate. Five, there is little difference between the learning that takes place in humans and that in other animals. Therefore, research can be carried out on animals as well as humans. Six, behavior is the result of stimulus response, i.e. all behavior, no matter how complex, can be reduced to a simple stimulus response association. Watson described the purpose of psychology as, quote, to predict, given the stimulus, what reaction will take place, or, given the reaction, state what the stimulus or situation is that caused the reaction. And seven, all behavior is learnt from the environment. We learn new behavior through classical or operant conditioning. And just to drive all that home, a quote from John Watson's book, Psychology as the Behaviorist Views It, written in 1913. Psychology as the behaviorist views it is a purely objective experimental branch of natural science. Its theoretical goal is the prediction and control of behavior. Introspection forms no essential part of its methods, nor is the scientific value of its data dependent upon the readiness with which they lend themselves to interpretation in terms of consciousness. The behaviorist, in his efforts to get a unitary scheme of animal response, recognizes no dividing line between man and brute. The behavior of man, with all of its refinement and complexity, forms only a part of the behaviorist's total scheme of investigation. Now, behaviorism developed over a period of about 50 years, starting with Ivan Pavlov. So in the 1890s, Pavlov was studying dogs, and he would feed the dogs as part of his studies. And he noticed that the dogs would sometimes start salivating simply because he walked into the room. The observation that the dogs associated his arrival with being fed was where his experiment began. So, some terms to know. Food, in this case, is an unconditioned stimulus. And the salivation of the dogs is an unconditioned response. In other words, unconditioned, neither the stimulus or the response were subjected to any human intervention. So what Pavlov added was what he called a conditioned stimulus, a bell that he would ring when it was time for dog food. Eventually, he found that he could get the dogs to salivate just by the sound of the bell, even when there was no food. While playing tricks on dogs, Pavlov also happened upon another exciting discovery, what was called stimulus generalization. Pavlov found that similar conditions, similar bells, or even certain tones could produce the same effect. Now, behaviorism continued to develop through the work of people like Edward Thorndike, John Watson, and of course, B.F. Skinner. So even though Pavlovian conditioning is considered to be outmoded today, it is still in use. Guess what species? Guess where?
You are now members, platoon 1093, series 1093, company B, 1st Recruit Training Battalion. I will now introduce to you the drill instructors responsible to me for your training. Senior drill instructor, take charge of these recruits and train them to become United States Marines.
Aye, sir. Again, my name is Gunnery Sergeant McWilliams, and I am your senior drill instructor. I am assisted in my duties by Drill Instructor Staff Sergeant Villa and Drill Instructor Staff Sergeant Matt. Our mission is to train each one of you to become a United States Marine.
Classical conditioning is a key strategy in turning raw recruits into Marines.
The purpose of recruit training is not to train a Marine for combat, but to train him to be a basically trained Marine. If I'm breaking down a misconception, where a Marine will be trained for further on for combat is when he leaves here and he goes on to specialized schools. What we're doing, though, here is preparing him for the discipline that he's going to confront at these specialized schools. How do we work the discipline in? One, instant and willing obedience to orders. How are we going to do that?
The first step in moving a group of independent-minded teenagers toward instant and willing obedience to orders is to trigger the reflexive response of fear.
You will always be at the position of attention, you understand me?
Yes, sir!
Do you understand me?
Yes, sir!
You will always be at the position of attention! Position of attention!
Most people reflexively respond to yelling with fear. So the drill instructors yell at the recruits. In this case, yelling is an unconditioned stimulus that elicits the unconditioned reflex of fear.
Okay, aye, sir.
Aye, sir.
Aye, sir.
Aye, sir.
Let me tell you something right now. Who is going to take you seriously if you don't talk with some conviction?
No,
shut up. I didn't ask for an answer.
First, he's going to use a voice. Now, some of the way we get our responses, recruits don't like the shouting voice.
This yelling is paired with the neutral stimulus of the drill instructor's hat, the distinctive campaign cover.
We call it cover identification. For us, it's a visual identification that they're going to sit there and focus on because they know this cover represents the Marine drill instructor.
Soon, the cover alone triggers a fear response, whether or not the drill instructor is yelling. The neutral stimulus has become a conditioned stimulus, and the unconditioned reflex of fear is now a conditioned response.
The recruits know that this represents a drill instructor. If I take this off, they might see me in a different light for a chance. When I put it back on, the recruits will respond and turn differently to me.
During the 3 decades Pavlov studied classical conditioning, he noticed 2 important variations called stimulus generalization and stimulus discrimination.
Stimulus generalization is where you respond not only to the original conditioned stimulus, but other similar conditioned stimuli. So the way Pavlov did this with dogs, he could condition a dog to salivate to a tone. And then he could condition the dog to salivate to a higher pitch tone or a lower pitch tone. And the dog would salivate regardless of whether the tone was high pitched or low pitched.
As we've seen, classical conditioning explains how we learn involuntary reflexive responses to stimuli that wouldn't ordinarily trigger that response.
You're moving too slow. Fix my rocker, sir.
Aye, sir.
But what about voluntary behavior, like marching or making a bed? How do we learn those?
In the early 20th century, others continued to build upon Pavlov's experiments. The first, and perhaps the most notable, was the man who coined the term behaviorism, John B. Watson. His most famous, and certainly his most controversial study, was called the Little Albert Experiment. It's hard to believe that this happened, but if you listen to our Renegade History series and you see what was passing as science around this time, I think it makes more sense. He would take a piece of metal and hold it over a baby and then smash the metal with a hammer and then show the baby, little Albert, a white rat. So eventually, we have this conditioned stimulus of white rat scaring the baby and causing him to cry. So that's pretty fucked. But Watson goes on to realize that there was also a lot of stimulus generalization taking place in this little human boy as well. He found that if he put on a white Santa Claus beard, he could scare the baby just as easily as he could with the white rat. Behaviorism was most likely brought to the schools by the man who is called the father of educational psychology, Edward L. Thorndike. John Taylor Gatto talks extensively about Thorndike in the Underground History of American Education, writing, according to Thorndike, the aim of a teacher is to produce and prevent certain responses. The purpose of education was to promote adjustment. In Thorndike's book, he urged the deconstruction of emphasis on intellectual resources for the young, advice that was largely taken by school people over the years. And, of course, behaviorism was further developed and largely brought to public attention by B.F. Skinner, who moved beyond the classical conditioning of Pavlov and Watson to what he called operant conditioning. And there are four methods of operant conditioning: positive reinforcement, positive punishment, negative reinforcement, and negative punishment. So just a brief description of each. A positive reinforcement would be like giving the pigeon food for pressing a lever. Good job, pigeon, or good job, child. A positive punishment would be an added imposition or burden. Positive because something is being added, but in this case as a punishment. There is also negative reinforcement, the withholding of praise for a bad job. And negative punishment, the taking away of something a pigeon or a dog or a rat or a child wants or looks forward to. So with Skinner, we see behaviorism move largely from classical conditioning to operant conditioning. Classical conditioning essentially depends on developing simple associations between events, while operant conditioning is about learning from the consequences of our behavior. Skinner believed that these consequences and the awareness of these consequences would lead to changes in voluntary behavior. In other words, in my words, people would learn to willingly internalize domination systems. People could learn to love their servitude. Skinner based most of his work on the ideas of Edward Thorndike, who, at the turn of the century, was studying learning in animals using cats. What he liked to do was put a cat in a box with a piece of fish outside and see how long it would take the cat to learn to escape. Father of educational psychology, Edward Thorndike. By the 1950s, like those of Thorndike, Skinner's ideas had made it into the schools, where they would remain right up until the present day. The creation of flesh and blood teaching machines was a separate project. So, the prevailing school psychology of the 20th century was primarily shaped by four men who spent plenty of time with rats and cats and dogs and pigeons, but probably not enough time with other humans.
Every moment of the day of a recruit's life is planned out from the moment when he wakes up at 5:30 in the morning till he goes to bed at 21:30. Every second is planned. So there's no time for any error. There's no time for any guesswork. There's no time for someone to go, okay, what am I doing now? Our standards have been passed down. They're tried, true, and they're tested. We make mothers of America proud when our recruits come back home. He knows how to make a bed probably for the first time. A lot of mothers marvel when their son comes back and says, you know, he made his bed for the first time, and all I had to do was turn the lights on.
Hi, Meredith. Welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
Hey, nice to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you. I received an email from you a few days ago. It seems like we have had a lot of similar experience in our teaching careers. You are a teacher in what you described to me as a public-private hybrid, and you teach elementary. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is, what that means?
Sure. Families have the option where I live of getting their children funded through the Board of Education. Some families choose not to do that. They don't want their children evaluated by the Board of Ed, or they don't want any sort of record or classification, so they can choose to enroll their child in our school and just pay private tuition as though they were just attending a private school. But the majority of the families do have their children either evaluated directly by the Board of Ed, or they'll pay a couple of, you know, maybe $10,000 to get their child evaluated privately, and then they will apply for public funding. If they are approved, then they can attend our school, and the money that would have gone to the public school comes to us instead. And, you know, the structure of how the funding actually works is really complicated. But, you know, most of the students have some sort of classification of learning disability or a speech impairment, you know, or some sort of language that allows them to receive special education funds. And then they attend our school, you know, and then we deal with the Board of Ed from there.
Yeah, I ask because I found myself trying, or struggling rather, to explain the school that I used to work at, which was a boarding school, and I called it a private school, but profits were private. Like, you know, there was a board and, you know, groups of investors that made money from the school. The school was managed on the site level privately, but all the money came from the states that sent us the kids. We also were handed down, obviously, a lot of regulations from those states to manage those kids. So yeah, it is kind of this public funded private hybrid situation that I was in too. And you teach elementary school.
Yeah, this is actually, I've been there for over 10 years. I've done some different age groups, but I've always worked primarily with the younger students. I think our youngest kids are turning 5, and actually kids can attend our school all the way up through high school. You know, so we sort of separate out the middle and high school, you know, they're in the same building and everything. But, you know, my certification is in special ed K through 12 and then elementary ed grades 1 through 6. So I've really stayed with the younger ones for a long time. But I do see how the kids progress as they get older because we're all one building.
Right.
So, you know, my oldest students are actually out of college now and in the workforce. I've kept in touch with them. And I, you know, I see a lot of my former students in the building all the time. So, you know, I see the benefits and the drawbacks of everything that we've done for them or done to them.
Yeah. Yeah, I can definitely identify with that. So I wanted to ask you this before we get started. You're a certified teacher, 15 years of experience. How did you stumble across this show?
The way that I found your show was actually I was looking for information on homeschooling because I have a young child. He's not old enough to really attend school, although he briefly attended daycare at one point. That's over now. That was not a good experience. But I came to the decision from a lot of different angles that it was really not going to work out for me or for him to put him in school. So I was looking for information on homeschooling. And yours is one of the resources that I came across. So I actually entered, you know, into your show sort of looking at the episodes about homeschooling, alternative education, and then the trivium and that sort of thing. But, you know, politically, I have changed my viewpoint quite radically. You know, I was an Obama supporter at one point, voted for him twice. You know, I definitely had liberal leanings for a long time, and it wasn't until people close to me started going through some really awful experiences with police and the state, and, you know, I can't even get into some of the things, you know, without opening up a whole other topic, but suffice it to say that, you know, I have seen the results of what happens when the state tries to intervene, and it's not good. And then I started looking back at a lot of the things that dissatisfied me about working in even a really what people would consider a great school and really seeing a lot of the problems from the inside. And it really, all of that came together to really change my views.
And School Sucks was there to explain it. Can I say that?
Yes.
Great. So how much, how many episodes roughly? You said you had been listening to the show at a pretty high volume as far as consumption is concerned. How many episodes would you say you've heard?
I think over the past couple of months, I've probably listened to maybe a few dozen episodes, and I've been skipping around a little bit, but some of the series, I listened to the series on the Renegade History. I was listening to the recent series on the scientific consensus and debate. I started the Trivium series, you know, and that jumped around to a lot of other episodes also. I feel like I'm catching up. I have a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah, we did a series last year, kind of lateral to the Renegade History series, called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. And I have a feeling that's going to come up in our conversation today. And I think people will understand why when I read an excerpt of the email that you sent me. There was a topic you wanted to explore. So you mind if I enter that into the record?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. You wrote, "One topic I would love to see more prominently on your show is the conscious use of behaviorism to control the thoughts and actions of students, particularly in special education. This is unfortunately an area in which I've had lots of firsthand experience, having worked primarily with kids with diagnosed disabilities, including oppositional defiant disorder and ADHD. Just one small example, this year my school adopted an oppressive system of constant praising for compliance and publicly displaying children on a chart labeling their behavior, which I have simply refused to use. Even so, the structure of the classroom itself ensures that the environment is only functional when kids comply, defer to me as an authority, suppress their own needs and curiosities, and accept the structure imposed on their bodies and thoughts, including chemically, in many cases." So, yeah, I read that, and man, I could identify. I'll tell you a little bit about what I had gone through in my career, but what are some memorable experiences where, you know, behaviorism you thought in your work environment was really front and center?
I'll just start with the most recent example that was in the email, which is at the beginning of the school year, we were introduced to this idea that the way to get cooperation from students was really to just impose this constant use of praise, that you might be wanting to start a class and you might say, "Okay, everyone, let's get out our books. Great, I see that Sally's getting out her book. Good job, Brett. You're almost ready to get started. Paul, you look ready also. Awesome. Okay, let's turn to the first page. Great job turning to the first page." You know, just like introducing the continuous use of verbal feedback. So you're calling students by name and you're acknowledging, you know, that they are doing quote unquote the right thing. One thing that I appreciate about that, incidentally, is that you're not calling out kids for doing quote unquote the wrong things, so that it's not turning into, you know, "I've asked you 18 times to get out your book and you're still not doing it. And, you know, you're making us wait and this and that." You know, so the idea is to just keep it positive, but to always be reinforcing constantly. And that if students are misbehaving, it's because you simply haven't reinforced them enough. So they should always want to get your approval. They should always want to know at every moment that what they're doing is right. This is before we've introduced any sort of reward in addition to the praise. And this is before, you know, we also have these little clips that you can move up and down, which is very common in regular elementary schools, as well as in special education programs, where students' names are publicly moved to a spot on a chart that tells them if they're behaving or not. So any child can look at the chart and they can see at any moment, you know, "Oh, Meredith's name is on warning. That means Meredith's doing the wrong thing."
Yeah.
You know, so it always ties back into the authority figure's evaluation of, you know, if you're doing well or not. And what you're being rewarded for is, you know, the school behavior, being quiet, listening, you know, as soon as you hear a direction, snapping right to it. You know, certain types of social interactions are rewarded, but, you know, others are not. So if I, for example, if another child is upset because, you know, they were disappointed, they got an answer wrong or something, you know, and we want a quiet atmosphere, nobody would be rewarded for going to that child and trying to comfort them, for example. You know, certain behaviors are rewarded because they help the group function smoothly. So if your goal is to have a quiet atmosphere and to have everybody working, you know, stopping to crack a joke with your friend isn't going to get rewarded, even though people say they put their children in school for socialization. Like, that's the right wrong moment to have socialization. So, you know, they learn that whatever they do needs to be approved by the adult.
Yeah, my audience is familiar with behaviorism. We've talked about it on the show before. It was some time ago. But the basic criticism is it's psychology that ignores the inner life. that almost entirely disregards emotion, even though as it went on, as it developed, I think it went from people like John Watson and obviously starting with Pavlov, people who said, look, we can't even look at that stuff because it's not publicly displayable. So there's no way psychology becomes an objective science if we're trying to incorporate people's emotions into our work. So leave that out entirely. Even with Skinner, as it developed, there was no free will. Humans didn't have free will. The idea that the mind is basically a blank slate and all of our behaviors develop through conditioning, all of our behaviors. And you were talking about this one form that sounds kind of, I mean, I could even think about being like 8 or 9 and being talked to that way with just that kind of continuous, overbearing positive reinforcement and thinking, what's wrong with the person who's doing this? This seems unnatural. This is like a little too much praise. But my experience was with the other three forms of behaviorism. So you talked a lot about positive reinforcement, right? Good job. Good work. I did the other three, positive punishment, negative reinforcement, and negative punishment. And this was like the beginning of 2002. My job title at the school was behavior manager. I've described it as kind of like a heavy. I was in a dorm with younger kids, and they had an educational setting within the dorm, which was isolated from the rest of the school. And when kids were bad, they came to me. So I would do the positive punishment, adding some kind of burden. You did this, so now this happens, this chore, this thing you don't want to do. I did negative reinforcement. You could do negative reinforcement without saying a word. You know, usually the words would be something like, bad job. But just by the fact that they were coming face to face with me, that was a negative reinforcement. And of course, negative punishment, a lost privilege, the loss of something they were looking forward to or wanting to do. I really operated in those three. Now, obviously, I would try to eventually get them on the right track and get them back into class where the positive reinforcements would come from the teacher. But it was behaviorism through and through. From there, I actually became the lead teacher of another specialized program where, you know, I thought about how this previous behavior manager experience had made me feel, and I started thinking about what I was doing more. And by the time I got to this next environment, it was horrifying how conditioned the kids were. And over time, I wound up working on changing it. It was really for the purpose. I mean, it wasn't good for the kids, obviously, but I also at the time, I think I was 24, you know, I wanted my job every day to be bearable. And in that Skinner box environment that I found myself in, it really was not. That's some of my experience to contrast with yours.
Yeah. And we definitely, there have been times definitely where it's come into the, if you continue to talk, you're going to miss, you know, 10 minutes of recess, you know, and sometimes it's tried, you know, you try to couch it as like, well, you know, if you're going to waste your time in class, then you have to make the time up at some other point, you know, to try to make it more of a logical consequence rather than just, you know, I am displeased with you. I am removing your privilege of having recess or free time or whatever. The school has gone through phases where it's been more of a, you know, take 5 minutes time out in the hallway, you know, and there was some debate about whether that was even legal to do, you know, removing a child who's diagnosed with a disability from an environment, you know, there are regulations about that, about whether you can deprive them of the educational time if their behavior is the result of their diagnosed disability. You know, so then you end up in a debate about whether or not they can control themselves or not, if they understand what they're doing, you know, if there's some sort of emotional diagnosis that is contributing to the, you know, problems. And the one thing that's never really examined is how the school itself might be contributing to the problem. You know, it's always that the child has not adjusted to the environment. It's never that the environment itself may be unreasonable or inappropriate or overbearing or, you know, whatever the case might be.
Yeah. Jacques Cousteau said one time, it would be foolish of us to study whales that were in an aquarium, right? And try to extrapolate from there large scale generalizations about the behavioral patterns of whales, because that's not a natural environment. So you're right. The school is never questions. It's all these questions about what can we do about this boy's or this girl's behavior in this demented environment, you know? And you said in your email that most schools are like these open plan offices where everything is public, where everyone can hear everything. Anything that you do is magnified because, you know, there's no barriers, there's no privacy. So how would you have any kind of personal educational experience in a setting like that, right? Because you're just so in tune with everything else that's happening, and you're bored, you know, and you're restless. So you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, one thing I will say is that the particular school where I work right now, you know, at times of the day, the students might be in a group of six or a group of three. The biggest group that they would ever really be in is a group of 24. That, you know, is for something like a gym class. But even so, the way, you know, when you are, you know, trying to do something that is new and difficult for you, you know, all of them have difficulty learning to read and write. They're still doing that in public every moment of the day, anytime that they're called on to answer a question, you know, and as much as you try to be sensitive, you know, and I try never to call on kids unless they're volunteering or, you know, they have advance notice or, sure, you know, you can try to alleviate some of the anxiety for them, but it's still, they're still put on the spot in front of all of their classmates who they're with all day long, day in and day out. You know, they can't so much as ask a question without that question being heard and judged by the people around them. They're also prone to distractions. So there are a lot of times where it might seem like they're misbehaving, but how many people can really do work where they have to concentrate with, you know, a dozen other people around them wrestling papers and tapping their pencils? You know, you have to really filter out what all the other people around you are doing, which, you know, I always hear the thing about school being for socialization, but actually what it's socializing you to do is really ignore everyone else. I mean, you certainly can't, you can't work together unless you've been given explicit permission. And, you know, sometimes that's called cheating when you attempt to work together because it's in a, you know, it's not the task that's been set out for you. But, you know, I think that there's the aspect of being constantly surrounded by others who are forming opinions of you, whether you want them to or not. You know, you never have the opportunity to do something in private unless, you know, there are a rare time during the day where you might request to talk to a teacher privately or a counselor. And then there's also the aspect of having to clamp down on any little behavior that could distract another child. So something as innocuous, you know, I have a student who is just very physically restless. You know, the word for that is hyperactive, but, you know, he's a kid. He's just restless. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, if he's standing up to work, which I allow, the next thing you know, he might be pacing back and forth in the back of the room. And if he were in the room by himself, I would have absolutely no problem. He could do the whole thing jumping on a trampoline for all I care. But now there are other students who have stopped what they're doing and they're watching him and they're, you know, paying attention to that instead of what they were doing before. So, you know, then I have to make a decision about, you know, who do I prioritize? Do I prioritize his need to move around in order to learn? Or do I prioritize someone else's need to not have someone pacing madly back and forth while they're trying to learn?
Right.
And, you know, the fact that it's a crowd of kids, you know, and even if someone does something minor, like I say, you know, okay, you know, Paul, we're getting ready to go to music. And he goes, well, I don't want to. You know, that's not really a big deal, except he just did that in public and he challenged what I said. So now whatever decision I make about how to react to that, that's being watched by everyone. So it affects the teacher's behavior, you know, how the teacher is perceived and what kind of environment the teacher can create. And it affects what the students do. So, you know, I think that the reality of it is that so much of what is considered discipline in schools or rules in schools, it's just about crowd control.
Yeah.
If you were able to somehow remove the crowd, then you might be able to react and help that child in a completely different way. It's one of the major reasons why I'm looking at homeschooling my own child.
Yeah,
because I don't want him to have to go through what some of the, what some of these kids have been through.
Yeah, I mean, it's not positive socialization when you have this cloistered environment that's basically training kids to be annoyed with each other, essentially, yeah, right? Or making kids be afraid to assert themselves, to ask questions. It's making them overly conscious of what is, I think, natural behavior, considering the environment and natural resistance. And one of the questions that I've had over the last few years is like, is there a way to make some form of school work. And I think there is, but it's incredibly rare as far as like what most public and private schools are. I think the Sudbury model, are you familiar with Sudbury at all?
I am.
So, you know, more open spaces, more exploratory, more student-centered, and that I think it would alleviate a lot of the problems that we've discussed so far. But you came to research homeschooling and be interested in homeschooling or home education largely based on the experiences that you've had in the school?
Yeah, my own experiences teaching, you know, and don't get me wrong, I think that for some of the students, you know, this is the best possible of what's available to them right now. You know, I do have students who've been through our school who have been to college, graduated college, you know, are pursuing their dreams. And so it worked well enough for them that, you know, it turned out okay. So it's, you know, I think the problem for many students, unfortunately, it's not really okay. I also have friends whose kids are just starting the process of going into preschool. My best friend's daughter is going into kindergarten, and she called me freaking out because they told her that her daughter wasn't ready for kindergarten because she doesn't know how to write her name yet. And so now it's sort of like, oh, I have to get my child ready for school. You know, it's not even that the school is going to do anything. You know, she hasn't even really been to kindergarten yet. It's that, oh, she already has to know all of this so that she's not behind when she gets to kindergarten, which is ridiculous. You know, the standards have become ridiculous. You know, the idea that, you know, we have to get our kids ready to even enter the system that's really supposed to be there to serve them is ridiculous. You know, there's all of this nonsense going on with the standardized testing and kids sitting for longer than it takes to get into medical school or law school. They're sitting for more hours spread out over several weeks so that you don't teach them anything during that time.
Right.
But then, you know, then you can, you know, all of my students, and I don't teach a testing grade. My students did not take tests this year, but they didn't have speech therapy for the past 2 weeks because the speech therapist had to go proctor exams for other students who did have testing. So we'll definitely make sure to deprive them of the services. So then that next year when they take the tests, you know, we'll see what effect that had when they actually go to be measured on their performance. You know, and I can see with my own child that he's an individual and I would like him to stay that way. I don't want to have to think about, you know, what's going to happen to him when he enters school. Is he going to be ahead of the standard and then he'll have to wait for everyone to catch up? Is he going to be behind the standard in some areas? You know, and then I'll have to worry about what that's going to do to his self-esteem. You know, I just don't want to have to be that parent going to that parent-teacher conference, you know, and as a teacher, when you enter these education programs, you know, you take classes on how to manage the families. And teachers are scared of parents. What do you do if the parent questions something, you know, and how do I manage? How do I make them feel welcome but not too welcome? How do I make sure that they're involved enough but not too involved? You know, there's definitely such a thing at school of having a too involved parent.
Yes, I know what that's like too. I actually just said that in a recent show. From the teacher's point of view, just because you have an involved parent doesn't mean you have a delightful one. And that's interesting, the words you used. We took classes on how to manage families,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what would be some of the insights that you gained from that?
You know, and I have to say, I went to a very progressive education school that they prided themselves on being progressive. So this is through that lens. One thing was, you know, to sort of acclimate families to some of the educational ideas. So if a parent, for example, questions, why isn't my child learning math the way that I learned math? Sort of how to educate the parent on how methods have changed over the years and acclimate them to the idea that our way is now going to be better. Or why isn't my child being taught how to, you know, sound out words with phonics? I mean, and when I attended grad school, I think that there was still this crazy reading debate over how kids learn to read and whether they should be taught phonics or not. The school where I work at now, the students don't learn to read unless there's some phonics instruction in there because they don't naturally learn to sound out words just by reading lots of words. They really need some sort of clue as to how to go about doing it. But, you know, if a parent questioned that, you know, the techniques of showing them a little bit of the program, but not too much, maybe directing them to an article, but only an article that's written for families. You know, don't show them an article written for other educators where there might be more of a debate. Otherwise, it might raise more questions. I think it was definitely about making them feel heard, making them feel like you were taking their questions seriously, giving them just enough information that would make the question go away. There was never any sense of, you know, maybe this is something we should be reconsidering. Maybe they're asking these questions because maybe this new way of teaching math isn't doing for their child what a different way of teaching math might do. And then it would come back to, well, you know, this is how our school does things and this is our policy. That would extend into behavior issues too. You know, I had a situation a number of years ago now where two kids were waiting for the bus. They got into some words with each other, and then one kid kicked the other. Mm-hmm. So the kid that kicked the other got in trouble. And he was saying that, well, you know, he was bothering me. I was telling him to stop. He wouldn't stop. So I kicked him. So, you know, at school, kicking is not okay. And, you know, it's not, that wasn't probably the best way to handle it. But then his dad came in the next day and said, well, I told my child that if somebody keeps bothering him and won't stop, he should defend himself. And that's how our family does it. So who are you to tell my child that he shouldn't be doing that? And so that could have been an opportunity to have a dialogue of, you know, how do we help your child defend himself in a variety of ways? You know, before sure. we get to the point where kicking becomes necessary, you know, but also why do you feel that it's so important that he defend himself? Like, what is the story behind that? And why do you feel that concern for your child that he might be picked on and unable to defend himself, you know, what's going on there? But it turned into this like, well, the school rule is that we don't kick. And when we kick, you know, there need to be consequences. And, you know, it turned into this very like, well, you're telling me you don't like the rule, but too bad, that's the rule.
And you have to talk like a bureaucrat, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And if one person is allowed to kick somebody else and not get in trouble, then somebody else is going to think that that's okay. It's sort of like trying to maintain a community standard that really hasn't been agreed to.
While giving up on opportunities for actually connecting with people and understanding, you know, where they're coming from, what their needs are, what their concerns are. There's no place for that in school, public or private, that I've seen so far.
Right. And I think that our school tries to make an attempt because, like I said, we have students with diagnosed disabilities. You can't just suspend a child for hitting if the hitting was the result of a diet, you know, if for example, they have, I'm trying to think of like some a child who has a classification of emotionally disturbed, which is a class, it's one of the classifications that can give you special education services.
Yeah.
A child with that classification might have some sort of psychiatric disorder or diagnosis that they might hit. And so you can't just suspend a child for having a psychiatric disorder. You know, that would be a violation of federal law. So you have to go through this other process where maybe that's when the behavioral intervention comes down hard and heavy. And you might have an individual chart with goals every 15 minutes. They're checked off, they're reinforced or they're not. You know, there might be, you know, sort of like a functional behavioral analysis where you're trying to figure out what is triggering the behavior so that you can manipulate the situation to not produce the behavior, you know, and you get into all these other interventions, which I think at the end of the day, sometimes they would have been better off if you had just suspended them rather than trying to manipulate out of feeling like they need to hit someone, you know, because maybe what they're reacting to is the unnatural environment in the first place. Rather than, you know, just trying to get them to sort of learn not to do that in front of you.
So you definitely mentioned in your email that there's a pharmacological component to what's going on at the school. Is there a clinical component? Is there one-on-one time? Are kids getting counseling? Is there any attempts at intervention beyond superficial behavioral controls?
They receive group counseling. It's called like Health and Human Relations. It's a weekly session with either a social worker or a psychologist, depending on how old the child is. The younger students see the social worker. And that's more talking as a group about things like, you know, in my class, some of the issues brought up this year were things like why you shouldn't just run up to somebody and hug them and squeeze them really hard, you know, giving them personal space, or actually checking to see if someone welcomes physical contact before you just run up and grab them, or, you know, using a nice tone when you talk to someone. In terms of actual deep-seated issues, you know, that's really more recommended that a child would see a therapist outside of school. So a lot of the kids do see therapists outside of school, or they might have some sort of, you know, tutoring or social skills group or some other intervention. Many of them do take medication for ADHD. This particular year, a lot of my kids don't, but it's been recommended by doctors or evaluators that they might benefit from it. So the parents are considering it. As they get older, I think, and the kids continue to struggle academically, I think more and more parents become willing to give it a try, thinking, you know, well, they're already classified as having a learning disability and being in a special education program, and they're not attending a mainstream public school. This is a special school for kids with learning issues, and they haven't caught up. So now, you know, and maybe they're acting out a little bit or they're unhappy. So maybe if we try medication, that will be the thing that is the tipping point that allows them to do well. And in some cases, it starts younger if there's more anger or rage. And I think the biggest thing is if the family is having trouble managing the child at home.
Yeah. Do you meet with parents at all?
Sure. I mean, we have formal conferences a couple times a year. And then, you know, I try to keep a really open door where we can talk at any point about really anything and, you know, try to brainstorm together. And I really try never to resort to, you know, putting it on the child and the family. You know, it's a difficult situation sometimes, like the example of the child who was pacing in the back of the room. He's one of the kids who the evaluator said to the parent, you know, he probably needs to go on medication at some point for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And the mother asked me, you know, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, I was sort of like, well, you know, he definitely has times where it interferes with what he's trying to do. You know, he definitely gets frustrated with himself. You know, he definitely feels the need to move, but, you know, we're trying some other things. You know, he can take a break whenever he wants. He can go walk around the hallway, you know, and like we try to put in all these other things in place. I don't know if she's going to end up putting this child on medication, but I will never turn to a parent and say, yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen cases where medication really doesn't work, where it makes the kids withdrawn or angry or yep. moody or, you know, just a little dull cognitively, or sometimes they even will hyper-focus, you know, and the attention will go in the opposite direction, whereas they before were attending to 85 different things all around the room and not the one thing that you're doing. Now they'll be sitting there and they'll be staring at their paper and you can't get them away from their paper, even when it's okay for them to stop, because they're so, their brain is now so super focused because of the medication that it's too far over the line in the other direction. And, you know, it's interfering with them moving on. It's not something that I really enjoy seeing kids go through. And then, you know, sometimes they'll try multiple medications. They'll try different doses. Sometimes the kids will go home after a full day of school and the medication wears off and they have like this huge hyperactive bounce where they're bouncing all over the house and they have an emotional crash, at, you know, when the medication is leaving their system at the end of the day. And so then they end up taking a homework dose so that yep. they get homework done at home, and then they can't fall asleep at night. And then that worsens the attention symptoms, because who can concentrate after not sleeping well? I mean, and actually a lot of these kids don't sleep well to begin with without right. the medication in their system. So sometimes it's more the fact that they might have a sleep disorder, or there might need to be some intervention on that end. And that might make some of the attentional issues go away and you don't have to introduce a stimulant into the mix.
But it also is this oftentimes swallow the spider to catch the fly, where you know, there's the medication that people think is needed for this good performance in school,
but then there's this crash, so more medication is needed, but then there's this restlessness when it's time to go to bed, so in cases more medication is even needed then.
Yeah.
You know, and I dealt with it a lot, and I was actually the med person for an entire building for a couple of years, so I handed out a lot of pills, a lot of scary pills to, you know, very small, very young kids. And I just wanted to go back. You mentioned this mother who sought your advice about medicating her child. Do you feel, and I know it's hard to make generalizations, but do you feel that's an anomaly that most parents are, even in a progressive school setting like that, are more on autopilot than they should be? In other words, they're expecting the school and drug interventions to solve problems that very likely originated maybe in the family environment?
Yeah, I think that they put a lot of trust in us. And yeah. I think they put a lot of trust in medical professionals, although not for everything, depending on what it is. A lot of these people have been through really scary experiences where maybe their children were ill early in life and they received medical intervention that really helped. We do have cancer survivors. We do have stroke survivors. We have kids who, you know, very difficult births. And the reason that I know about some of the difficult births is it's actually in their social history. So, you know, routinely parents are asked about their pregnancies and their family home life, and all of that is information that a teacher could see in the social report when the kids are admitted to the school. You know, so that's an aspect that I never thought about until I became a parent. And then I suddenly went, oh my God, I can't believe some of the questions that these parents get asked. But anyway, yeah, they put a lot of trust in medicine and in school. And I think that they often feel out of their league, that their children are experiencing such distress that they couldn't possibly know what to do on their own. So they need to ask an expert for help. And, you know, sometimes their family pediatrician isn't the expert because that person was maybe a little slow to realize that there was a problem. So maybe they put their trust in the psychiatrist or the evaluator. I get asked a lot of questions, and I also get asked to intervene a lot. You know, can you make my child read at home? I try to have him read at home every night and he won't do it. But if you're the teacher, so if you ask him to do it, he will. And, you know, that's something else that as a parent, I suddenly went, whoa, wait a minute. Like now I'm intervening in your relationship with your child because you have something that you value that you want to get him to do, but he's learned that it doesn't matter unless the teacher tells him to do it. What's that about? Like yeah. That's another moment where I went, whoa, wait, like this is an aspect of school culture that I never questioned all my years as a teacher. But there's something seriously wrong with that.
Yeah. You know, I think, too, that like when you're a parent, I mean, I'm sure being a parent is hard enough on its own. But when you have a child who experiences all of these challenges and there's all these interventions, psychological, maybe even government gets involved, the school gets involved, there's counselors, you're being told a lot of things. And from my experience, I didn't interact with parents that much the first 4 years of my career. I interacted with parents a whole lot in the next 8 or 9 years of my career. And one of the things I noticed was this perceived powerlessness.
Yes.
You know, like who is going to help me, even with healthier children, children who weren't drugs, children who didn't have a special education diagnosis, kids who weren't even struggling in school. I mean, I remember having some of these conversations when I was just like, you know, tutoring a kid with low grades or a kid who was struggling to get the numbers up on the SAT. And I saw this powerlessness. So you agree with that. You've seen a lot of that. Another general question I would have is because you have so much experience, prevailing attitudes that parents have towards their children. Is it frustration? Is there, you know, lack of sympathy, lack of understanding, lack of trust that kind of comes through as a pattern, or has that pattern changed at all in your career?
I think that when children have any kind of history of struggling, I think that sometimes there is frustration toward the child that they want confirmation from me that their child is actually trying, that sometimes it might appear that their child is not trying hard enough, or you know, they know how to do it, but sometimes they don't. Does that mean that they're lazy? And sometimes if they really strongly believe in the medical diagnosis, like a feature of attention syndromes is that inconsistent performance. But if they've been given the label, but the parents are not really sure if they buy into the label, they might prefer to think like, well, my child could control it if he wanted to, and sure, he just doesn't. I think that there's a really deep worry about what's going to happen to the kids when they're out in the world, out in public. Are people going to look at them and, you know, judge them? So we have to really make sure that everything is perfect because they don't want their kid labeled or judged by strangers. Incidentally, a lot of these parents send their kids to camp or to summer programs and don't tell the camps or the summer programs that the kids have been diagnosed with anything, because all year long they feel like they're laboring under this oppressive diagnosis and they want the kid to have a break, and they don't want people to make assumptions about their child based on, you know, what it's like for them during the school year. So there's some awareness that this is not real life, that, you know, they have these disabilities. Sometimes, you know, it comes out more at school when we're harping on the things that don't come naturally. And then they might go to horseback riding camp, or they might go, you know, to computer camp, and the disability doesn't really show up. So they prefer not to disclose. In the summertime, I work for a museum education program. It's an informal class, a week long, and we actually do get students who probably would have some sort of diagnosis or special ed classification during the school year, but the families almost never disclose that. And I've actually had a lot of conversations with my fellow workers about why that would be. And, you know, we've really come to the conclusion that it can feel really oppressive to families and to kids to have gone through this experience and be part of the system, and that they feel that there is judgment that goes on as a result of their kids struggling in some way, and they really want to get away from that. So they almost never choose to disclose this information unless it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, I would think that's especially true with things like oppositional defiant disorder, so-called, and ADHD, because there might be this subtle realization on the part of the parents that if the kid is actually doing something he or she enjoys, this disability that they have doesn't really seem to show up. An avid horseback rider doesn't really experience much ADHD when they're on the back of a horse.
Yeah, and it's actually, I mean, I have a student in my class this year who, you know, she is always brimming over with physical activity. And, you know, when she gets excited, she'll like jump out of her seat and do a little dance or something. It's actually really cute. But she's very scattered to the four winds in our little classroom environment. It's very difficult for her to get anything done, but she'll come in and she'll be so excited about being able to like jump over a small barrier on a horse for the first time. Hmm. And looking at her in the classroom, you might ask yourself, how can she possibly maintain enough focus to do something physically dangerous, potentially like riding a horse? But it's a much more natural environment for her. And if she were able to be outdoors more, and if she were able to have that intense physical activity, I think I think being on the horse provides this input for her in her body. You know, I'm not an occupational therapist, but I think a lot of these kids would really benefit from more intense physical activity, and not just for like the 20 minutes at recess that they get during our school day, where we go up to, you know, a little playground that's like padded within an inch of its life, and they can't even like climb up the slide without being told that it's dangerous. I mean,
yeah. Now, so. I was a student in elementary school before they were bubble wrapping kids the way they do today, right? And I remember just bursting out of the school like, I'm going to go crazy. And recess was like the place where we would get in trouble, you know, because finally we were free, but the rest of the environment had been so boring and so restrictive that at times I felt like I didn't know what to do with myself. And this was in the 80s when you could get hurt outside.
Right. You know?
We didn't have helmets and elbow pads on like kids do today. So I know I just looked at the clock. Because we're a little short on time, I was wondering if we could just change directions a little bit, because I had some more questions I wanted to ask you going back to the behaviorism stuff.
Sure.
You mentioned that this year the school changed policies and started keeping these more public records of kids moving up and down behavior scales. Do you know why that happened, like how that decision was made?
I think that it was because, I mean, and actually thinking back on it, there was always a little bit of that. We used to have this other system that we used in the past. But, you know, a lot of the teachers, I think, intuitively realized that it really wasn't a great system, that they didn't enjoy moving the kids' names around publicly. And a lot of people kind of stopped using it. And I think that they identified that as a problem because it wasn't consistent enough. And these kids need consistency in order for their behavior to improve. So they brought in a consultant from, I believe they're from NYU Child Study Team. It's actually an outside person who's developed this system. And they tried to make it more positive so that you could move a kid up to super student, or they could be good friend, or, you know, engaged listener, whatever the labels are. And there might be like something down at the bottom that was a little bit less positive, but at least, you know, the thinking was if you're recognizing kids for great behavior, then everybody will be more on board and more likely to use it. But I think, I mean, I almost immediately said, forget it. I'm, you know, this is just embarrassing kids whose names aren't moved. Or it's even possibly calling out kids for being a little too good, you know, that you're setting up something where somebody's considered a teacher's pet, or they're, you know, everybody, you know, something falls on the floor and a kid picks it up. Great job, honey. You get moved up to great helper. And then someone else will like knock a piece of paper on the floor and then pick it up so they can get moved up to great helper. You know, so it becomes this like competition to see who can get their name moved for what.
And it's, super student or not, great helper or not, it's a mechanism that is stripping everybody of intrinsic motivation.
Absolutely.
Right? Now,
it's so pronounced.
All school is behaviorism. I mean, behaviorism, the way school works now, maybe Sudbury or models like that aside, it is the water that we are in as fish psychologically. You know, and it's interesting, too, that behaviorism, even though it was very popular at the end of the 1800s and really the first half of the 1900s, was kind of uprooted as the psychological norm by what was called the cognitive revolution in the late 1950s. But behaviorism really pushed forward in the schools right up to today. I mean, behaviorism is not taken too seriously, I don't think, in the psychological community anymore, but it is still how pretty much all schools work. And sometimes it's more overt, sometimes it's more covert. There are other learning theories like cognitivism or social constructivism or connectivism. We've talked about some of these on the show before. But I would just like to close by asking you the question, have you ever tried to raise concerns about what you see? And if you haven't, what would you like to say to the people who are making these decisions at the school?
I have raised concerns in the past, especially when I have students who have really not adjusted well to their environment. And I've had a few who've actually had to leave the school, not many, but a few over the years. Often it's they've been struggling for a while. And a lot of what is said in response is things like, well, that's our program and it's not right for every child. Or, you know, what would we do if we didn't have this chart? You know, we need, or, you know, my former principal would say things like, well, why shouldn't the kids get recognized if they're doing well? You know, we used to have like a school store where kids could buy rewards with tickets that they've earned. And, you know, after a while, the rewards kind of lose their effectiveness, you know, to the extent that they work for what you want them to work for. And so when you would tell her this, she'd be like, well, I just want them to know that they're doing a good job and that they're trying so hard. And these kids struggle so much in their lives. They should have one place where, you know, their efforts are recognized. So it's sort of like interpreted as, oh, we're not controlling their behavior. We're not replacing their judgment with our judgment. We're just giving them a pat on the back and making them have good self-esteem about themselves. And like, to me, that is completely not what we're doing. But to people who really believe in this, they genuinely feel that they are helping the kids overcome their struggles and feel better about themselves. And that is the story that they tell themselves.
It's nice to have a story.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you mentioned self-esteem, and I've been thinking a lot about that lately. We did a series on it last year, and since you're digging the show and you're consuming it at a pretty regular clip, if I dare, I might like to give you a homework suggestion, which would be to check out that series. It's 8 parts. It's probably like a 12 to 14 hour time commitment. But I thought we could, since you mentioned it, since they're having this kind of counterfeit self-esteem idea going on at your school, we could talk about what these 6 pillars of self-esteem are, since obviously while you finish up your career, you said you are leaving once your contract is up. and you're planning to homeschool your own child, this, I think, is such an important concept for teachers, for parents, for us as adults. It's not that somebody tells us we did a good job. It's things that we practice of our own volition because we are internally motivated to practice them, to have better lives for ourselves, not to please others.
Right.
So can I run through them real quickly? It'd be a nice way to end the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll even contrast them with these, you know, behavior school environments. So the first one is the practice of living consciously. This would be, you know, respect for facts, you know, being present for what we're doing while we're doing it, seeking information, being open to new information or even feedback, you know, and it's really about seeking to understand not just what's going on around us, but also our inner world, right? Now, school, because it's behaviorist, strips out that opportunity. Behaviorism doesn't factor in the internal world. It's all just outcomes-based, essentially. The second practice is self-acceptance. Owning, experiencing, taking responsibility for our thoughts, feelings, action, without evasion, without dissociation. Being able to experience our own emotions without really liking or endorsing what we're doing. We're just kind of acknowledging that this is reality. This is what's happening. So if we're in environments that are unaccepting, I think it's very difficult to practice that for ourselves, especially if you have this artificial positive reinforcement thing going on. Like, that's not authentic. You know, you're not awesome because you opened to page 2. You know, I mean, you're not bad for opening to page 2, but to make a performance out of as a teacher out of the satisfaction with a 7 or 8 year old opening to page 2 is very inauthentic. The third one is self-responsibility, that, you know, we're the author of our own choices. And, you know, it's not about assigning blame, but it's about asking, you know, what's the next action, essentially. So behaviorism is also, because it is conditioning, and what goes on in school is mostly operant conditioning, there is no request for anyone taking responsibility for themselves. They're just essentially input-output machines. Here's the stimulus, here's the response. The fourth one is the practice of self-assertiveness, refusing to, and I'm actually, I have some notes here. This is some of Brandon's notes from the summary of the book. Refusing to fake the reality of who we are or what we esteem in order to avoid disapproval is a big part of that, right?
Huge.
Being authentic in our dealings with others. So again, we see how behaviorism of the schools is anti-self-esteem. It's all fake. That's a fake reality, you know, a chart that kind of ranks kids based on being super students or good helpers based on subjective valuation, right?
Yeah.
So, and then what happens if a kid actually asserts his or herself in school? They're usually bad for doing it.
It's just the wrong time, or it's, you know, embarrassing to somebody else, or, you know, if everyone was allowed to do that.
Yeah. And you see how these kind of build on each other. The fifth one is the practice of living purposefully, identifying our short-term and long-term goals or purposes and the actions needed to attain them. So we organize our own behavior in the service of our goals. We don't have our behavior organized or conditioned for us in the service of somebody else's goals or in the service of a community's goals, which speaks to that cloistered environment of school where everybody is kind of nervously just trying to not stick out too much.
Right.
And the last one is the practice of personal integrity, living with congruence between what we know, what we profess, and what we do, telling the truth, honoring our commitments, exemplifying in actions the values we profess to admire. It's hard to stand by your values, so-called, if you didn't get to choose them, you know, because what our experience, the experiences that we've shared today are with younger kids, you know, but I've worked with teenagers. I've worked with college kids, and I didn't really feel like they chose their values either. I felt like their values were imposed on them by, you know, family, by culture, by school, maybe by even religion in some cases. So,
or by the peer group.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. What a great example. The peer group. So they're not even choosing values. They're conforming to a value set. And then there's also this internal sense of inauthenticity. authenticity, right? Like, this is not the real me. This is not who I am. So I would say the next time there is a discussion in your school about what's going on there, how behaviorist it is, and then the justification is the term self-esteem, you could mention that book. The author is Nathaniel Brandon.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great.
So Meredith, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this. I bet there's a whole bunch more we could talk about in the future if you ever wanted to come back. And since you're going to be, you know, continuing to consume the show, please send me an email anytime. I'd be very interested in your feedback since we've had such similar experiences and we're actually kind of at similar places in life now, right?
Right. Right. Thank you very much. This has been so fun. I won't take all that they hand me down. They can't I smile, though I will frown. And I'm not gonna take it all lying down. Cause once I get started, I go to town. Cause I'm not like everybody else. I'm not like everybody else. I'm not.